listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We must abandon the failed policy of nation building and regime change that Hillary Clinton pushed in Iraq, in Libya, in Egypt, and in Syria.
That was the Republican candidate for president at the time, Donald Trump, at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio, July 2016. It should be noted that he received a standing ovation from the assembled thousands of Republicans for that statement. This past Monday, he seemed to be taking an entirely different position on the question of regime change with respect to Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. This was President Donald Trump at Florida International University on Monday.
Hello, Miami. I am thrilled to be back in the state I love with so many proud, freedom-loving patriots. We're here to proclaim a new day is coming in Latin America. It's coming. In Venezuela and across the Western Hemisphere, socialism is dying and liberty, prosperity, and democracy are being reborn. Today, our hearts are filled with hope because of the determination of millions of everyday Venezuelans, the patriotism of the Venezuelan National Assembly, and the incredible courage of interim president Juan Guaido. The people of Venezuela are standing for freedom and democracy, and the United States of America is standing right by their side. Let me begin by thanking the great leaders here today who have been such incredible champions for the cause of liberty. And these people love you, and they love Venezuela, and they love Cuba, and they love all of the places that we're fighting. Newly elected and already doing an incredible job, Governor Ron DeSantis. A man who I call, especially when we're talking about Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. He knows a lot, and he's a friend of mine, Senator Marco Rubio. A great governor. He gave Ron a little bit of a head start. He did a fantastic job in Florida. Former governor and now Senator Rick Scott. Somebody that I've gotten to know very well, especially as to the fact that my heart is in Venezuela. Representative Mario Diaz-Balart. Ambassador Carlos Trujillo. Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunes. Your new and great Attorney General Ashley Moody. And to so many other dedicated public officials that are in this room right now, we thank you very much for being with us. Thank you. Thank you also to Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, who's with us, and Ambassador Lighthizer. Ambassador Lighthizer, I have to say, just got back from a place called China. And boy, oh boy, we're making a lot of progress. Nobody expected this was going to be happening. We're making a lot of progress. In the meantime, billions and billions of dollars are coming into our treasury. It's very simple. All works. That never happened before. We don't know the feeling in this country, but now we know the feeling. We also want to extend our deep appreciation to the president of Florida International University, Dr. Mark Rosenberg, for hosting this important event. Finally, I want to thank each and every person in this wonderful audience who has made your own stand for human dignity, and that's probably just about all of you. And I want to especially thank the Venezuelan exile community that has done so much to support President Guaido, to organize aid for their compatriots, and to do just a lot back home. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you. We're with you. We are profoundly grateful to every dissident, every exile, every political prisoner, and everyone who bears witness to the horrors of socialism and communism, and who has bravely spoken out against them. Thank you very much. The fact is, you've seen the crimes, and you've seen the corruption. You have seen the hunger and the suffering. You have heard the anguished pleas for help. You have protested and protested with respect, but loudly. And you have prayed for the day we can now see, which is just ahead, the day when all of the people of this region will at last be free. As we meet today, the people of Venezuela stand at the threshold of history, ready to reclaim their country and to reclaim their future. Yeah. Not long ago, Venezuela was the wealthiest nation by far in South America. But years of socialist rule have brought this once thriving nation to the brink of ruin. That's where it is today. The tyrannical socialist government nationalized private industries and took over private businesses. They engaged in massive wealth confiscation, shut down free markets, suppressed free speech, and set up a relentless propaganda machine, rigged elections, used the government to persecute their political opponents, and destroyed the impartial rule of law. In other words, the socialists have done in Venezuela all of the same things that socialists, communists, totalitarians have done everywhere that they've had a chance to rule. The results have been catastrophic. Almost 90% of Venezuelans now live in poverty. In 2018, hyperinflation in Venezuela exceeded 1,000,000%. Crippling shortages of food and medicine plague the country. Socialism has so completely ravaged this great country that even the world's largest reserves of oil are no longer enough to keep the lights on. This will never happen to us. Already, more than 3 million Venezuelans have fled Maduro's brutal opposition, and brutal it is. Today, we are honored to be joined by Amita Perez, the mother of Oscar Perez, a courageous Venezuelan police officer. You know the story. In June of 2017, Oscar piloted a helicopter over the city of Baruta with the banner 350 Liberty, a reference to Article 350 of the Venezuelan Constitution, which states, "The people of Venezuela shall disown any regime, legislation, or authority that violates democratic values or encroaches upon human rights." Oscar said he wanted to give the people hope. He loved the people. He fought for the people, and they loved Oscar. But Oscar was gunned down and killed by Venezuelans. So you know this very well. You all know the story. By the Venezuelan security forces, viciously. Aminta, our hearts break for your loss. Oscar gave his life for the freedom of his people. We all have hope today because of great, great people and patriots like Oscar. Please. Oscar was an incredible man who will not have died in vain. A few weeks ago, on January 23rd, Venezuela's National Assembly invoked the Venezuelan Constitution to declare the president of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, as the country's legitimate leader. In one of his first acts, President Guaido invoked the same constitutional article that Oscar carried through the skies to notify the world that Maduro was illegitimate. Within 30 minutes, the United States was proud to be the first nation in the world to recognize President Guaido. And by the way, John Bolton is here. Where is John? Working hard. Today, more than 50 countries around the world now recognize the rightful government of Venezuela. And the Venezuelan people have spoken, and the world has heard their beautiful voice. They are turning the page on socialism, turning the page on dictatorship. And there will be no going back. Peace-loving nations are ready to help Venezuela reclaim its democracy, its dignity, and its destiny. All the nations in our hemisphere have a shared interest in preventing the spread of socialist tyranny. Socialism, by its very nature, does not respect borders. It does not respect boundaries or the sovereign rights of its citizens or its neighbors. It's always seeking to expand, to encroach, and to subjugate others to its will. The twilight hour of socialism has arrived in our hemisphere, and frankly, in many, many places around the world. The days of socialism and communism are numbered not only in Venezuela, but in Nicaragua and in Cuba as well. Do we love Cuba? Do we love Nicaragua? Great countries. Such great potential. Remember that word. Such unbelievable potential. In the meantime, we must all work together to end a humanitarian disaster. As we speak, there are truckloads filled with hundreds of tons of desperately needed humanitarian supplies stopped at the borders of Venezuela and waiting to help the millions and millions in need. 2 days ago, the first U.S. Air Force C-17, that's a big, beautiful plane, landed in Colombia, loaded with crucial assistance, including thousands of nutrition kits for little Venezuelan children. Unfortunately, dictator Maduro has blocked this life-saving aid from entering the country. He would rather see his people starve than give them aid, than help them. Millions of Venezuelans are starving and suffering while a small handful at the top of the Maduro regime plunder the nation into poverty and into death. We know who they are, and we know where they keep the billions of dollars that they have stolen. Incredibly, there are members of the Venezuelan military still barely supporting this failed dictatorship. They are risking their future. They are risking their lives and Venezuela's future for a man controlled by the Cuban military and protected by a private army of Cuban soldiers. Maduro is not a Venezuelan patriot. He is a Cuban puppet. That's what he is. And remember that hundreds of millions of dollars used to be paid to Cuba, but no longer, because they no longer have that kind of wealth to be able to do it. So things are changing, and they're changing fast. And today I have a message for every official who is helping to keep Maduro in place. The eyes of the entire world are upon you today, every day, and every day in the future. You cannot hide from the choice that now confronts you. You can choose to accept President Guaido's generous offer of amnesty to live your life in peace with your families and your countrymen. President Guaido does not seek retribution against you, and neither do we. But you must not follow Maduro's orders to block humanitarian aid, and you must not threaten any form of violence against peaceful protesters, opposition leaders, members of the National Assembly, or President Guaido and his family. We seek a peaceful transition of power, but all options are open. We want to restore Venezuelan democracy, and we believe that the Venezuelan military and its leadership have a vital role to play in this process. If you choose this path, you have the opportunity to help forge a safe and prosperous future for all of the people of Venezuela. Or you can choose the second path, continuing to support Maduro. If you choose this path, you will find no safe harbor, no easy exit, and no way out. You will lose everything. So today I ask every member of the Maduro regime, end this nightmare of poverty, hunger, and death for your people. Let your people go. Set your country free. Now is the time for all Venezuelan patriots to act together as one united people. Nothing could be better for the future of Venezuela, and nothing could be better for the future of another captive nation, Cuba, than the rebirth of freedom and democracy in Venezuela. For decades, the socialist dictatorships of Cuba and Venezuela have propped each other up in a very corrupt bargain. Venezuela gave Cuba oil. In return, Cuba gave Venezuela a police state run directly from Havana. But this is a much different day, and those days are over. The ugly alliance between the two dictatorships is coming to a rapid end. A new future is beginning. All of us in this arena, and thousands and thousands and thousands of people outside, you have to see it, are united because we know the truth about socialism. In Venezuela, in Cuba, in Nicaragua, and all around the world. Socialism promises prosperity, but it delivers poverty. Socialism promises unity, but it delivers hatred and it delivers division. Socialism promises a better future, but it always returns to the darkest chapters of the past. That never fails. It always happens. Socialism is a sad and discredited ideology rooted in the total ignorance of history and human nature, which is why socialism eventually must always give rise to tyranny, which it does. Socialists profess a love of diversity, but they always insist on absolute conformity. We know that socialism is not about justice. It's not about equality. It's not about lifting up the poor. Socialism is about one thing only: power for the ruling class. And the more power they get, the more they crave. They want to run healthcare, run transportation and finance, run energy, education, run everything. They want the power to decide who wins and who loses, who's up and who's down, what's true and what's false, and even who lives and who dies. In short, all of us here today know that there is nothing less democratic than socialism. Everywhere and anywhere it appears, socialism advances under the banner of progress, but in the end, it delivers only corruption, exploitation, and decay. With us today is David Smolansky. David was one of the youngest mayors in Venezuelan history when the Maduro regime removed him from office and issued a warrant for his arrest. David fled into Venezuela's treacherous southern jungle. Eventually, David reached Brazil, where he was welcomed with open arms. Today, David lives in exile in the United States, where he continues to speak up for the Venezuelan people. Sadly, David is the third generation of his family to flee the agony of socialism and communism. David's grandparents fled the Soviet Union in 1927, and his father fled communist Cuba in 1970. As David said, "The difference I want to have for my father and my grandfather is to go back to my country. My grandparents never went back to Kiev. My father has not been back to Havana. I hope I can soon return to Venezuela." I think that will happen, David. Thank you very much, David. I think it'll soon happen. Your courage, David, is an inspiration. And not only David, many of the people in this room, you've been through much. But you see it coming to the end. You see it really coming to an end for the first time. For the first time, you're seeing it. Because the United States, a true great nation, is behind you. And so, as the United States stands up for democracy in Venezuela, we reaffirm the solidarity with the long-suffering people of Cuba and Nicaragua and people everywhere living under socialist and communist regimes. And to those who would try to impose socialism on the United States, we again deliver a very simple message. America will never be a socialist country. free, and we will stay free now and forever. We know what freedom can do in Venezuela because we have seen that future right here in Doral. We know what freedom can do in Cuba because we have seen that future right here in Miami. We know what freedom can do in Nicaragua because we have seen that future in Sweetwater. And one day soon, with God's help, we are going to see what the people will do in Caracas and Managua and Havana. And when Venezuela is free, and Cuba is free, and Nicaragua is free, this will become the first free hemisphere in all of human history. It was my great honor to be with you today, and the First Lady's great honor to be with you today. We are winning. We are winning on every front. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the people of Venezuela. God bless the people of Cuba. God bless the people of Nicaragua. And God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
More on that later this week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is the U.S.-led coup against the legitimate government in Venezuela faltering? Also, as Russia, Turkey, and Iran search for peace in Syria, Washington beats the drums of war against Iran. And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Cross-talking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Xavier Moreau. He is the founder of the Center of Political Strategic Analysis, StratPol. We also have Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in London, we cross to Alexander Mikiris. He is the editor-in-chief of TheDuran.com. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let me go to Alexander Mikiris in London here. I remember the days, the years ago, when the U.S.-led coup against Chile was in progress, and Nixon asked Kissinger to make sure that the economy there would scream. Is that the same game plan that we have here with Venezuela? Because it seems like the shock and awe of regime change is spent, and now we're going into a different phase of this forced regime change in Caracas. Go ahead. In London.
I think to answer your question, I think that is exactly what the game plan is. I think the intention originally was to provoke action by the military, in effect a military coup against President Maduro, who, as you correctly say, remains the internationally recognized legitimate president of Venezuela, representing Venezuela in the various international organizations, including the United Nations. The military did not act as anticipated. It has remained solidly behind President Maduro and his government. So now the plan seems to be to try to blockade Venezuela as far as possible, tightening the grip on its oil exports, which are its vital energy resource, ramping up sanctions against the country, increasing economic hardship there, whilst at the same time using a humanitarian aid, or what's called humanitarian aid, to try to destabilize the situation politically, internally, by creating facts on the ground within Venezuela itself. In other words, by shifting the economic balance to the Guaido group, which the United States recognizes.
Dima, we've heard humanitarian aid before. Coming from the lips of a man that has been in the business of forced regime change in Latin America, and that is Elliot Abrams. Well, he didn't have a very good time, did he, in front of Congress? Because a congresswoman, Omar, asked the most germane question, is, well, you lied to this committee 30 years ago. Are you going to lie again? I'm paraphrasing. It's very interesting that the United States wants to increase the blockade of Venezuela, while at the same time sanctioning it. So it wants to get humanitarian aid, whatever that is, because there's a humanitarian crisis, quote unquote, but they're part of the part of the problem when it comes to sanctions.
Well, I think the U.S. Planners who actually planned this coup, I think they confused Venezuela of 2019 with Russia in 1989 or with Iraq in 1991. Usually naive people are impressed by the mere notion of humanitarian aid, like they're dropping bombs, but they're also dropping on Iraq, you know, sacks of grain or of flour, you know, things like that. They impress naive people. Well, Venezuelans, just like Chileans, just like Salvadorans, they have had it all, you know. Yeah. In the 90s, they had, in the 80s, they had the ultra-liberal regimes, which supported the United States, which conducted neoliberal reforms. So they know that there can be humanitarian aid, and there can be a lot of talk about free enterprise and about helping the poor. And at the same time, you may be very unhappy, very poor, having nothing to eat. So they are more experienced than us Russians in 1989, when we were really impressed by humanitarian aid.
They've all seen this film, and they know how it ends.
There is maybe another reason, because if you compare with the other color revolution, which worked, actually it worked when the current power is already pro-West. You know, look at Yanukovych. He was not the enemy of the West. He was not the friend of Putin. He gave all the oil potential resources to Western companies, including the U.S. one. He didn't do what he promised during his campaign. It means doing with Russian language an official language. And he didn't join the customs union as he promised during the campaign. Right. Look at Shevardnadze. Shevardnadze was even is now considered by a Twitter when he was a minister of foreign affairs in the USSR. Even Milosevic in 1996, he was considered like the Balkanic Gorbachev after Dayton, when he more or less betrayed the Serbian of Republika Srpska.
Bosnian Serbs.
Yes,
Bosnian Serbs.
Them, so the problem now for the U.S. government in Venezuela, that Maduro did many mistakes, but he didn't make this mistake of having close to him some Western good advisor, exactly as Yanukovych had 5 years ago, and that the one he lost the power.
You know, Alexander Makarios, let me go back to London here. That is the reason why the opposition, this Guaido character, they don't want to have any kind of negotiations, because the government is repeatedly, over and over again, even asked for international fora for negotiations to resolve this, because the government in Venezuela knows that if they deal with the United States directly, that means surrender everything, okay? And we have at the same time the Chinese turning around saying that they're going to maintain their relations with the current government. The reason why we're talking about it, because as I said in my introduction, it looks like the coup is faltering, at least at this point. But that's why they have Elliot Abrams. Go ahead, in London.
Yes, I think that Maduro has responded to this crisis, actually, with surprising intelligence, at least surprising to me. I mean, he hasn't overreacted by rushing off and rounding up Guaido and all these other people.
Yeah, because he's walking around. Yeah, he's just walking around.
Exactly. But of course, he's walking around in a box, in a sense, because I think the expectation was that there would be massive protests behind Guaido. That hasn't really happened.
No.
And I think Maduro understands that, in fact, by playing a waiting game with Guaido, actually Guaido loses momentum and loses credibility also. Yeah. And I think Guaido also understands that if he starts to negotiate with Maduro, then, of course, what is he negotiating about? Maduro has said he's not prepared to agree to a transition arrangement whereby he gives up power.
Right.
Does Guaido negotiate with Maduro on the basis that Maduro is the country's legitimate president? If he does, he completely loses the game.
Yeah, Dima, go ahead.
Well, but if Maduro stays, and obviously even The Guardian admits that Guaido's campaign is losing steam, I'm quoting them, if Maduro stays, it's going to be a terrible embarrassment for the European Union. Because
still another thing to be embarrassed about.
18 out of 28 member countries recognize Guaido as the new leader of the country. If it hadn't been for Italy, the EU as an entity would have recognized Guaido, and this guy is just incapable of doing anything. And the people in Venezuela who have the experience of U.S. intervention in Latin America, they're very skeptical about this humanitarian aid. You mentioned Elliot Abrams' dialogue with Ilhan Omar, a Muslim member of Congress, Republican. She reminded him of an interesting thing.
She's a Democrat.
She said that, would you support an armed faction with Venezuela that engages in war crimes, crimes against humanity or genocide, if you believe they were serving U.S. interests as you did in Guatemala, El Salvador and Nicaragua? And Abrams did not find a better answer than to say, the day that Duarte was elected in a free election, El Salvador has become a democracy. Our listeners.
That's why in El Salvador, what percentage of the Salvadorian population lives in the United States now because of the glorious democracy there?
And because of Duarte. So for our listeners and our watchers in Latin America who don't know Ukraine, Poroshenko is the same as Duarte. So far, the results of his rules have been the same. So if you want to, if you want Ukraine, if you want Russia to go through the same fate as El Salvador and its neighbors, then support Poroshenko.
Well, doesn't care about the fate of these people.
In my opinion, they start caring about it because, look at, they fail in Syria. They are failing now in Ukraine because the country is collapsed. Is collapsing, and now they are failing in Venezuela. So who will trust the U.S.
and the European Union,
the State Department for the next revolution?
Right.
Okay, you are in a position in one country, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the U.S. one, come to you and promise you the power.
Promises, right?
Will you trust him after Syria?
Let me go to Alexander before we go to the break here. My gut feeling is, Alexander, is that Trump, being as disinterested in foreign policy as he's well known to be, I think that my sense is that he's given Pompeo, Bolton, and Abrams a green light up into, but not for, war. So go ahead with your humanitarian aid, backing these opposition people, and other individuals there that will be willing to defy the legitimate government, but they won't go to a military solution. That's my sense right now. Go ahead in London.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think there would be huge resistance, not just by Trump, but by many people in the United States, to military action in Venezuela. In fact, if they go down that road, it will be an admission that this operation that they've tried, which is to try and overthrow, has failed. Exactly. I'm going to just add one very quick point about this, which is that, in my opinion, this thing was clearly not thought through well. They didn't understand.
You think?
and what they did by recognizing Guaido in that way, with Vice President Pence telephoning him to say that they recognize him as the legitimate president of the country when he clearly isn't, has rallied support.
Exactly. All right, Alexander, I got to jump in here. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, let's talk about another forced regime change that's in process here. We had a summit in Warsaw. It was basically framed as Middle East regional security, but of course it wasn't. It was directed against Iran. Even the host country, Poland, after being suffering the tongue lashes of the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, about the European Union staying in the nuclear deal, which Poland is adhering to as a member of the EU. It was a lot of cajoling, and it was absolutely a complete failure because they didn't get the results that they wanted. Also, we had Benjamin Netanyahu showed up there, and on his website talking about unity, about going starting a war against Iran, which, of course, Netanyahu changed, okay, because there were delegates from Arab countries. You can talk behind closed doors and smoke-filled rooms about your relationship in the Arab world with Israel, but you don't do it so publicly, not yet.
Well, I think that the people, I didn't hear anyone calling that conference a conference on the Middle East because it's simply not true. They all called it anti-Iranian conference, and that was the real name of it, you know.
That was the substance of it.
Not only because of the substance, but also because the representative of the Palestinian side, Mahmoud Abbas, didn't come. He refused to come.
There were no high-level EU officials as well.
Yes, and he refused to come for a very good reason. He still feels insulted by the transfer of U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And also, why should Palestinians come to a conference where people are discussing basically the ways to contain Iran? Iran has been helping Palestinian refugees for decades. So it was not about Israel and Palestine. Everyone understood it. It was about Iran. And I just loved the formula suggested by Michael Pompeo. Pompeo declared that both peace and stability in the region would just not be possible without confronting Iran. End of quote. That reminds me of O'Brien in the 1984 by George Orwell. Remember, war is peace. Peace is not possible without confronting Iran. What does it mean, confronting Iran? A war, right? So if Pompeo in Warsaw is war is peace, then Abrams talking about democracy in El Salvador under Duarte, that is freedom is slavery. You know, remember O'Brien says freedom is slavery, war is peace. You know, we have the same kind of talk here.
Right. Xavier, I mean, where is the statecraft in all of this? I mean, the optics of it, the bombastic language. Washington calls these conferences and just expects everybody to get in line. And the European Union really snubbed it, okay? They were not going to participate in this charade, okay? I mean, we went from Venezuela, we went to this conference. There's just no learning curve. There's no statecraft. There's no even pretense to diplomacy.
In my opinion, it's Syrian losers. Mm. They want to conceal the defeat because it's a complete defeat against Russia, against Syria, of course, against Turkey and against Iran. So they try to move the front line in another place, and they want to conceal this defeat. But maybe we will talk about it later. But in my opinion, the first reason is this one. And there is unfortunately the very warmonger Israeli policy, and which want already. Is revenge. They continue bombing Syrian territory, pretending that there is some Iranian warehouses or troops, and I'm not sure it's it's very effective like bombing things you can't see, but it's a symbolic. It's a question of symbolic.
In a way, it's kind of a militaristic virtue signaling. Yeah. In a way, Alexander McCurs, let me go to you in London. I mean, it's very interesting. As this was going on in Warsaw, you had in Sochi. We had Iran, Turkey, and Russia discussing the very difficult end game for Syria because the Turks made promises in last September, and they're having a hard, hard time honoring those. But the Russians and the Iranians seem to be expressing strategic patience still, maybe. What do you think, Alex?
Well, absolutely. Can we come back to that word you use, statecraft, the contrast between the lack of statecraft in Warsaw, where the United States convenes a conference where nobody of any importance turns up, exposing its own isolation on this issue, and responds by criticizing its own allies in grossly intemperate language, and the very careful, patient diplomacy we see in Sochi, where, as I said, as you said correctly, the Russians and the Iranians are now trying to get the Turks out of the hole the Turks have dug themselves into.
Or at least make them honor their pledges. Okay, it's not really a big, thick red line there. Keep going.
Not exactly. And what I'm now hearing, in fact, is that there's now discussion about some sort of joint operation with the Russians and the Iranians joining the Turks to try and bring some kind of order to Idlib province. That is diplomacy. That's how diplomacy works. You talk quietly in measured ways. You look for solutions. You understand people's concerns. You try to satisfy those concerns. You don't convene conferences without preparing anybody.
Wow, Alex, I had no idea you're so old-fashioned. Okay, Dima, jump in.
Well, let me remind you about our beloved mainstream press, how they said in the beginning of the Syrian conflict, Russia is aligning itself with Shiite Muslims and quarreling with the Sunni Muslim world. Now we have in Sochi, the Iranian president, the representative of a Shiite Muslim country, actually a Shiite cleric, President Erdogan of Turkey, a representative of the Sunni Muslim world, probably the most important one, and President Putin, discussing the ways to resolve the Syrian crisis. Isn't it a success? And on the other hand, in Warsaw, you know, the Polish media was so proud. We are like the Madrid conference in 1991, you know. This is what I wrote, read in Rzecz Pospolita. You know, let me remind our Polish brothers. In 1991, people talked about peace in the Middle East. They were not talking about the ways to attack Iran. So with Poles, it's always like that. You know, when they supported Napoleon, now when they support Trump, and they have good relations with Israel, I want to tell them again and again, Polish brothers, don't do it. You will wet yourself. You will get wet.
They have an amazing capacity to pick the wrong side here. Let's stay with Syria here. We can go back about a year ago where we had this alleged, because we've always said alleged on this program, even after all the media storm, the alleged chemical gas attack in Douma. And we have a BBC producer coming out and saying that this was just made for show for camera.
Oh, yes.
And as a result of the allegation, Donald Trump ordered the bombing of Syria, illegal under international law. Go ahead.
Myself, as a French, I remember when the Minister of Defense and of Foreign Affairs presented the proof. You know, it was five pages document. And the proofs, the evidences, were some videos they found on the internet, and the French specialists were thinking that there is some evidence that they use chemical weapons.
Your source is YouTube.
Yes. For them, it's old. For us, it's prohibited. YouTube, you know, it's a fake news. But when it's analyzed by the government analysts, so of course, it's good. And so, what I'm waiting for now is from Paris, from London, from even Berlin, and of course from Washington. Please give the price. Please answer to this. But you know, in my opinion, they won't say anything.
No, because of course they won't.
I looked at on the French on the French TV, the ones who were so anti-Assad supporters, and they even didn't talk about BBC report. We are not talking about RT report.
Okay, let me go to Alexander in London. You know, Xavier is absolutely right. I mean, here we have a major news outlet, one of their producers making a very important admission, but it will never get to the point of apologizing to viewers for pushing a narrative that ended in violence, and when violence was used against international law with no real evidence being supported it all, made public here. But they just keep going on as if it never happened. Of course, somehow, some way, it was Russia's fault that somebody allegedly used gas in Syria. You know, that's such a dysfunctional sense of what the media should do. Go ahead in London.
Well, can I just say, I mean, it's important to say it is a BBC producer. It is not the BBC itself.
I was very careful with my words. Very careful.
But it goes directly to the point of what you're making, because, of course, the OPCW, which is supposed to investigate these things, has now actually officially reported that there's no evidence of sarin here. And this particular producer is saying that the film of the incident in the hospital, which is, I think, the one that Savio was referring to, that appears to have been staged. Now, what this episode shows is the vital importance of making a proper investigation, a proper, impartial, internationally recognized investigation before you go to war. In this instance, there was no such investigation. There was a rush to judgment. Missiles were launched. Extraordinary things were said across the media, and people and property were destroyed or killed. And that is not how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed first to find out what happened, find out whether or not incidents like this are exercises in manipulation, which it increasingly looks like this one was. And then you come to some sort of international consensus about what you do. That's not what happened. And that's the lesson that should be learned. And that's what the media should be talking about. Well, and of course, it isn't doing it.
So old fashioned, Alexander Mercurius. My goodness. 5 seconds.
I know. Yes.
Well, just the names, you know. The BBC producer who stated that he can prove without a doubt that the Duma Hospital scene was staged was Riam Dalati. And I ask our viewers, if they can, go and look for the boy, Hassan Diab. This was the boy shown on this video who gave a press conference in OPCW denying
this
attack.
And you were gracious enough to tell our viewers that months ago here. Yes. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.